recorded earlier at the Royal College of Music. Here's Andrew McGregor.
Welcome to the Concert Hall of the Royal College of Music. We're going to be discovering a great deal more about the man behind the Seventh Symphony, given its UK premiere in this evening's prom, Danish composer Pia Nørgaard. Now, usually I'd be sitting here with the composer himself. That's how these portraits work. But we know that there's a degree of optimism involved in asking Pia to join us today. He just turned 80, and his age and rheumatism make it increasingly difficult to leave home for this kind of celebration of his music. He's sorry he couldn't join us himself, but writer, broadcaster, and contemporary music enthusiast Ivan Hewitt is here with me, and so are the students from the Royal Northern College of Music who've been preparing Nørgaard's Dances Around Jupiter and his sixth quartet, Tintinnabulary, for us to hear. So it may be a little less of a self-portrait than we normally have, but there's no reason why we shouldn't achieve a good likeness. Now, Ivan, you've met Pia Nørgaard several times. Give us an idea of what the man's like physically. To meet him, how does he come across?
Well, he's very tall, for one thing. You have to look up to Pia, in more than one sense. And he's like a sort of tall Viking, really. You know, he's very blonde. There's a short story of D.H. Lawrence where Lawrence talks about a character as being like a piece of the outdoors come indoors, and that's what Pia Nørgaard is like. You know, you'd imagine him in his seven-league boots striding over a Danish hill somewhere. And he's also very charming and extraordinarily courteous. That's the other thing about the man. He's got this old-world courtesy, which we will, in fact, hear later.
And I read about Pierre in his early years as a child and as a student being rather shy and a little withdrawn, which seems to be characteristics which came through as he developed as a composer. Is that still something you're aware of when you meet him?
Well, he's somebody who lives very much in his own world. Shy, I think, wouldn't be quite the right word now, but certainly very self-contained. It's very hard to imagine Pia Nørgaard doing anything for publicity's sake, you know. A feature of his childhood was that he was very interested in theatre. He used to build little theatres and make little models of characters and invent fantastical dramatic scenes, rather like Ligeti, actually. And it took him a while to discover that music was going to be his real talent.
Because he'd make mini musicals, wouldn't he, and draw cartoons for them as well.
He would. He was very ambitious as a child. You know, it would be the complete show he'd present, you know. And, of course, he has kept his flair for music theatre since. You know, there are operas and music theatre pieces in his catalogue.
And what about early musical background? Because I suppose, well, growing up in Denmark from the 30s through to the 50s, he was musically Scandinavian first, wasn't he? Or Nordic, rather than European by instinct.
Yeah, absolutely, yes. He has always said that he's a great admirer of Carl Nielsen, particularly, and the most eminent follower also of Carl Nielsen, who was a man called Wagner Holmbo, who Nielsen studied with. Nørgaard himself describes his music of those days, the 50s, as completely wild, and he was amazed that Wagner Holmbo took him on. But he did, and in fact became his favoured pupil, in fact, and Nørgaard was called upon to finish unfinished works of Holmbo. And his early works do show a kind of Sibelius-like fascination with musical processes which are organic and unending and don't seem to aim at an emphatic end point and have a suggestion of illimitable horizons and a strange kind of, I know it sounds a slightly cliche thing to say, but they do have a kind of Nordic light to them, you know, a kind of cool intensity.
It's interesting hearing you say that because I read him disagreeing with the idea that Sibelius is in some way about nature, the way he writes music. I mean, what did he say? It's that the music works in the same way that nature does, but it's not actually about nature.
Yes, now that's a very interesting distinction. I think Nørgaard is somewhat like John Cage, interestingly, with whom he has nothing else in common, really, in the sense that he's not interested in how nature looks and sounds. You know, he's not interested in making attractive portraits of landscapes, for example. What fascinates him is the mechanisms that underlie the visual appearance of nature, like mathematical processes, like the processes of growth. He's really in love with self-generating processes like the Fibonacci series of numbers, you know, which multiplies itself endlessly. And he's interested in nature from the molecular level to the cosmic, I think it's true to say. It's not just the landscape that interests him, it's the wheeling of the spheres and down to the molecular level.
And we are certainly going to be hearing elements of that in the two chamber works we have. And it's interesting hearing what Nergal himself picks up on to talk about in his own music, because we will be hearing from him as part of this composer portrait, because he recorded some reflections on the way his Seventh Symphony works, especially for us. And he made these recordings only yesterday so that we could hear them ourselves. Here he is, just for us.
Hello. It's a pleasure for me to give a very short introduction to my Seventh Symphony, which is very characterized in the first movement by small drums, 14 in number, going downwards like this: boom, 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 beep, beep, boom, boom. Movement having this bright character. I was very fascinated of the uncertainty of when does the next boom come. And that is into the contrast of second movement, a very simple little melody. And then suddenly interrupted by an enormous C major chord. It's like all the movement has this very forceful start and then it's dying out. Last movement goes on, in fact, where first movement ended, as if we have cut some part of the first movement, ending noch einmal, as the German says, we would say, still you would hear this boom, 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 and that finishes the work. Thank you for your attention.
It's almost as if he was here with us, isn't
Indeed.
It?
Indeed. What a shame.
Pierre Nergal sending us some reflections on the Seventh Symphony, given its UK premiere in this evening's prompt. So, Ivan, how much are we going to hear of those kinds of elements in the chamber music that's ahead of us? Rhythmically, there's some very interesting things happening.
There are, indeed. I mean, I should say first, we'll hear quite a lot of C major, in fact, because both pieces are somewhat obsessed with it. They keep returning to it. And when you hear that bottom C, of course, in the string quartet, it's a bottom C string, so it has a nice resonant twang to it. In the saxophone quartet, it makes a pretty good fruity noise as well, I must say. And one feels it as a kind of tonal center, but not in the sense of a grammatically tonal center. It feels almost as if the music is rooted in it in the way that a natural phenomenon is rooted in its fundamental vibration. I suppose that's the metaphor to conjure it. You asked about the rhythm. There is certainly quite a strong reminiscence of that little drum, descending drum figure in the quartet. It seems to be a characteristic of his more recent music that he wants to conjure up. I mean, the way I read it is that he's looking for a horizontal equivalent, a temporal expression, of the kind of non-harmonic, the kind of irregular partials, upper partials that you hear in things like bell sounds. And of course, that quartet is called Tintinabulary, and it is very obsessed with bells.
Well, we don't get an explicit program for the work. You wouldn't expect it with Pierre Nobel, would you?
Absolutely not.
But he does write something to introduce the score. He says the bell-like association of the title reflects the special texture of the work, like the changing overtones of a struck, resonating bell. The four instruments are unified in a single line, which is broken up in a multitude of changing dynamics and rhythmic patterns. And we have lots of those harmonics ringing against each other, don't we? And the rhythmic layers are fascinating as well, layer upon layer, and changes of speed, doublings, quadruplings of speed.
Yes, on the page it looks pretty fearsome. To listen to it, I think it's not so fearsome. And the reason for that, I think the thing that separates Nurgle from people who share some of these interests, like Stockhausen, for example, is that Nurgle never loses his attachment to things which are rooted in music's culture. And I think he's interested in bringing together things which come out of the natural world, like these sequences of you know, non-harmonic partials, with things that are very reminiscent of the human musical world. And so, for example, there's a I think quite a funny moment in this quartet where a tangle of descending lines, which itself prompts the rooted sea to skitter about in a slightly schizo-like way, is suddenly brought to an abrupt halt by what sounds like a really old-fashioned perfect cadence. It's, you know, like the kind of cadence you get at the end of a hymn, you know, da-dum. And it happens at top speed, and it's just thrown into the texture so fast that you could miss it. And it's a kind of little joke, I think. And there are little jokes dropped into the music quite often.
Well, let's hear it. To perform Pierre Nurgle's Tintinabulary, his sixth string quartet, please welcome our four string players from the Royal Northern College of Music in Manchester. Violinists Qian Wu and Edward Brenton, viola player Matthew Kettle, and cellist Joe Zeitlin.
Thank you. Thank you.
Tintinnabulary, the bell-like overtones of the string quartet number 6 by Danish composer Per Nørgaard, performed for us at the Amaryllis Flemming Concert Hall of the Royal College of Music in London by our quartet from the Royal Northern College of Music in Manchester. We're going to hear the saxophone quartet Dancers Around Jupiter from 1995. And, has he a history of stargazing?
Well, as I said before, he likes nature from the cosmic range down to the molecular, and he's a man who wants to find connections between the macro and the micro, you know, and between the human and the natural. And some years back, he was invited to give a lecture at the Aubra Festival, where he was featured composer. And I'd like to quote one or two things, if I may, from his lecture, because it really gives you a very strong impression of the man himself. It was given in 1999, and it was focused very much on the imminent millennium, as it then was. And this prompted all kinds of millennial thoughts in Nørgaard, which prompted him to connect the fact that humanity tends to become gripped by crises around about the year 1000. Or two, with conjunctions of the planets, believe it or not. He was delighted to discover that the planets are in a meet together in the same conjunction in their orbits only once every 1,000 years, and he thought this was a wonderful discovery. He was even more pleased to discover, if I can just quote this, that if you looked at the ratio of the different spinnings of the planets round the sun, they made a very gratifyingly arithmetical sequence, which he found very pleasing. And then this lecture then becomes an extended riff on the idea of number underlining, you know, human nature and physical nature. And if I could just quote one thing, he says he was prompted to write this saxophone quartet that we're going to hear by hearing the sound of cosmic rays as recorded by one of the Voyager spacecraft that went into orbit around Jupiter in 1989. And it did indeed record some wonderful sounds. It had a curiously musical flavor to them. They seemed to consist of a kind of fundamental note plus a harmony above, you know, very gratifying to a man of Nogor's temperament. And he says, the most dramatic thing I find is that it's above these major chords, there's a minor harmony, and then above that, I can hear sounds from E to C sharp, which indicates a 12-tone field, a division of the octave into 12 equal intervals. So there it is, you see, in space. He finds musical material in space.
And you can actually hear these sounds if you want to, because there is a recording on YouTube, which I think might have been... well, it's certainly where we've heard them, of these sounds. They're not acoustic sounds, they're acoustically generated, but it's the ion waves generated as the solar wind collides with Jupiter's magnetic fields, and these have become the middle movement of the quartet. What about the outer movements, Ivan? Because this is where the dancing comes in. If we can just have a very brief description of what's happening.
Yes, the outer movements are not at all cosmic. Each movement is dedicated to a different person, and the central movement is dedicated to the NASA scientist who was instrumental in launching this Voyager spacecraft. The two outer movements have two different dedicatees, one of whom was, in fact, a Danish dancer and choreographer. And it's a tribute to her, as it were, dancing spirit, so to speak. And Nogor pursues this astronomical conceit in the sense that he likes to think of the two outer movements as spinning in orbit round the central movement. And indeed, the central movement does have a very different character. The outer movements are not so far removed from what you've just heard, in fact, particularly the first movement, which, again, harps very much on this bottom C, almost as if the baritone saxophone has acquired a bottom C string and harps on it.
Well, let's hear it. To perform Pierre Nogor's Dancers Around Jupiter, let's welcome our musicians from the Royal Northern College of Music. This is the Borealis Saxophone Quartet, Miriam Rentelin, Melina Zeleniuk, Gillian Blair, and Daniel White.
Thank you.
Dances Around Jupiter, the saxophone quartet by Pia Nørgaard from 1995, played by the Borealis Quartet from the Royal Northern College of Music. Well, he couldn't be here himself for this Proms composer portrait. He sent his best wishes. Our very best go back to Pia Nørgaard for his 80th birthday year. Our next portrait is this coming Monday. It'll be a portrait of Olga Neuwirth. Meanwhile, thank you very much to Ivan Hewitt for interpreting the scores for us, to the Royal College of Music for having us, to the audience here in the hall, and most of all, to our two quartets of young musicians. Thank you very much indeed.
This evening's Proms concert portrait was recorded earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music. It was presented by Andrew McGregor, who was in conversation with Ivan Hewitt. And just a reminder that there's another Proms composer portrait, as Andrew said, next Monday, August the 13th, when Andrew talks to the German composer Olga Neuwirth, who has a new work premiered at the Prom that evening. This is BBC Radio 3. It's a quarter past ten. Coming up at 11:45, Verity Sharp introduces Late Junction. But now, from the stage of the Royal Albert Hall here in London, here's Katie Derham with the second of this evening's Proms. Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Welcome to the Royal Albert Hall for this late night prom. A prom's debut, indeed, for one of the great icons of British musical theatre. A man dubbed the last great romantic, the actor, writer, heartthrob, and composer, Ivan Avello. I'm Katie Derham, and as usual, we are live here on BBC Radio 3, the home of the BBC Proms, and you'll also be able to watch this concert on Saturday evening on BBC Two at 8 o'clock. Now, Ivan Novello's songs conjure a gentle, more elegant age of clinking cocktail glasses and dressing for dinner, lingering glances and romantic escapism. The stage is set for an evening of nostalgic glamour. Our stars tonight are Sophie Bevan, Toby Spence, and Simon Callow. Sir Mark Elder conducts the Halle Orchestra.
Golders Green Crematorium. A cold March morning in 1951. The hearse, heavy with flowers, passes through crowds of mourners, several thousand strong, many of them sobbing, held back in places by lines of police. This was Ivan Avello's last audience. He had been the most widely admired figure in the British theatre of his time. Struck down in his late 50s, he was the deviser, composer, and star of a string of major musicals, shows which, since the mid-1930s, had been a byword for spectacle, glamour, and romance. Only hours before his untimely death, he had been starring in one of the most successful of these, King's Rhapsody, at the Palace Theatre, in which he played a Ruritanian king who gives up his throne for love. And it was love, rather than sorrow, that defined the atmosphere at his funeral. In a notoriously backstabbing profession, he inspired an almost universal affection. At the funeral, as in the cinemas and in the theatres where he acted, women made up the majority of mourners. And of course, as on stage, there was music. Music that had been so much a part of his life since his earliest childhood in Wales. One tune above all, written in the dying days of the Second World War, had lyrics made all the more poignant by their author's death. We'll gather lilacs in the spring again and walk together down an English lane. Until our hearts have learned to sing again. When you come home once more. Music had made Ivor a star, aged only 21. Born in Cardiff in 1893 as David Ivor Davies, he had been inspired, or rather shoved, into a musical career by his mother, the formidable Madame Clara Novello Davies. Mam, to Ivor and his friends, was a leading singing and speech coach, director of the Royal Welsh Ladies Choir. She had music studios in Mayfair and in Manhattan, a woman of indomitable spirit. She defied the German U-boats during the First World War, traveling back and forth across the Atlantic to keep her lucrative American business afloat. She had immense energy and unbounded ambition for her only son, Ivor, who by 1914 had already shown youthful promise with several songs published, one of them when he was 17. And when Mam announced that she was about to write a patriotic number, he knew that for the sake of the family reputation, he'd better get in there first. He worked on the song with an American poet, Lena Gilbert Ford, working together in his flat above the theatre that's now named after him. Ivor and Lena were struggling for a central image, a central idea for their song, when in came a maid and stoked the dying fire in his drawing room. That was it. They had their song. It perfectly captured the public's optimistic mood at the time. Surely the boys would be home by Christmas. But the horrors deepened. The war dragged on. Lena Gilbert Ford, who had written the words, was with her son killed in a Zeppelin raid on London. Increasingly, the song was played less as a confident march and more as a poignant prayer for the troops' safe return.
They were summoned from the hillside. They were called in from the glen, and the country found them ready at the stirring call for men. Let no tears add to their hardship as the soldiers pass along. And although your heart is breaking, make it sing this cheery song. Keep the home fires burning while your hearts are yearning.
Shall bend, and the English man is silent.
When the war finally came to an end, Ivor Novello found himself in Sweden. Having crashed several planes while training to be a pilot, he'd been given a harmless desk job and was delighted to have the chance at last to use his music on his country's behalf. Alarmed at the way Germany had been whipping up sympathy in the neutral country by sending its orchestras on tour, Britain had retaliated with Ivor, whose musical talents were more than matched by his devastating good looks. As his friend and rival, Noel Coward, was later to remark, there are two perfect things in this world, my mind and Ivor's profile. It was these good looks that launched his next career, when a Swiss film director happened to see a photograph of Ivor, brushing away the fact that he was a composer, not an actor at all. This is the boy I want. Louis Mercantin cast him in L'Appel du Sang, The Call of the Blood, in 1919, to the amazement of Ivor's friends and the delight of his bank manager. So began his career as a leading silent movie star. Two of his films were directed by a promising young man called Alfred Hitchcock. The first was The Lodger, 1926, where Ivor played a character suspected of being a serial killer, which is surprisingly convincing. More characteristic, perhaps, of Ivor's style was the following year's Downhill. Playing a public schoolboy expelled for a crime he has not committed, he asks with trembling lip, so the caption tells us, does this mean, sir, that I shan't be able to play for the old boys? Much to his mother's dismay, Ivor's real love was, in fact, the theatre. And like many an actor before him, he used his cinematic stardom to get through the stage door and into the West End. But not content with that, he took to writing plays for himself. So in the 20s and early 30s, he starred in an enormously profitable succession of plays and films, all the while continuing to write music for revues and West End shows, including Tabs, Arlette, and Who's Hooper. In The Golden Moth, his lyricist was none other than P.G. Woodhouse. This twinning of talents is not as surprising as it may seem. Ivor had a lively sense of humor, most memorably demonstrated in his 1921 setting of Dion Titheridge's And Her Mother Came Too. Mam saw the joke in the song, but she still pressed Ivor to focus on writing operas, the career she'd always wanted for him. As the years went by, her taste for the bottle noticeably increased. Whenever she stayed in his country house in Berkshire, Ivor hid the alcohol. He frequently had to bail her out, too, with large checks. Nonetheless, he always made sure that at his first nights, Mam had a box of her own filled with flowers. The nearest she got to her dreams for Ivor were when, in late 1934, the West End producer Harry Tennant took him to lunch at the Ivy. Tennant was worried about the Theatre Royal Drury Lane, which had been a white elephant since the enormous triumph of Noel Coward's Cavalcade 3 years earlier. But aware of the meeting's potential importance, Ivor ensured that this was one occasion when Mother did not come too. Ivor, said Tennant, you compose. Don't you have something up your sleeve for us, something that could save us from closure? It's funny you should say that, replied Ivor, eyes shining with enthusiasm and not a little claret. Let me give you an idea of the plot. In a nutshell, it's about a handsome young man, that will be me, who travels to a far-off kingdom, Krasnia, where he saves the life of a gorgeous young opera singer. Someone tries to kill her because she's the mistress of the king, you see. Anyway, they eventually both happen to be on a cruise ship when there's another attempt on her life with a bomb this time. And the cruise ship sinks on stage, of course, and they both swim to safety. And once on shore, they meet a group of gypsies and have a lovely gypsy wedding. Marvellous, said Harry, barely believing his ears. Can you come round in, say, 2 days and tell all of this to the Board of Governors and play some of the songs? Ivor then spent the next 48 almost sleepless, coffee-fueled hours trying to produce enough material to persuade the board that he had written a hit for them. He had. When it opened in May 1935, Glamorous Night certainly lived up to its name, with lavish sets, plenty of spectacle, a huge cast and a dazzling wardrobe. This being a Novello show, the gypsies wore lace and cloth of gold. The cruise ship sank gracefully in front of an astonished audience, and the hero and heroine swam to the shore, arriving without a hair out of place. The leading lady was the American opera singer Mary Ellis, while I